Our next event is the 15th annual Don Barrett Lecture. There's a biography of Don in the program book, but really quick, he was the founder of this organization, NIFIC, when he was at the CDC Office of Public Affairs, and unfortunately he died in 1993. And as a lasting memorial, our organization decided to have an annual lecture in Don's name. And you know, Don was really, really big on the connection between the CDC and our organization, the state at that time, which was basically state health communication directors, which obviously you can see we've expanded way past that. Every year we select a timely speaker who represents the concepts and ideals that Don had for this organization, and those are concepts and ideals that we use day in, day out. This year we are very honored and privileged to have one of the leading voices in risk communication, crisis communication, emergency communications, whatever you want to call it, and Peter Sandman. Risk communication became, and all those other words, became very popular. It became a very interesting buzzword after 9/11 and then the subsequent anthrax attacks. However, Peter's been doing this long before 9/11. He's acted as a consultant on issues such as oil spills, labor management disputes, vaccine, autism connections, and then moved on into the terrorism, biological attacks, and disease outbreak. He's known it for a lot of things, but he's probably most noted for the risk plus hazard equals outrage component theory that we've all used, we've all explained to our constituencies, and so we're thankful for him. Most important, he's also a neighbor of mine in New Jersey. He's from Princeton, New Jersey. Very honored to have as the 15th annual Don Barrett Lecture, Dr. Peter Sandman.
Thank you. I also have stories to tell, but I'm not the handsome hero. Lots of problems, some victories, I guess, no sex. And no pictures. They asked me, when they asked me to give this presentation, I said, hey, terrific, I can talk about risk communication. And they said, no, we don't want you to talk about risk communication. We want you to talk about your life in risk communication. And the NIFIC people were very, very clear that I was not to have any handouts. I was not. You don't know how upset this made me. I was not to use the overhead projector. They didn't say I wasn't allowed to say risk equals hazard plus outrage, but I certainly got the sense that they wanted something more personal than that. So I'm going to try to do that. I will have handouts and I will use the overhead projector tomorrow. For those of you who are coming to tomorrow's session, and I should take a minute to clarify, tomorrow's session is not devoted exclusively to dirty bombs. Some of the publicity has implied that it might be, and it won't be. It's going to be an overarching introduction to risk communication and to the three key paradigms of risk communication. It will use radiation issues as a kind of a touch point. I'm sure we will talk about dirty bombs some when we get to crisis communication, but it's going to be much broader than that. And I'll have handouts, and I'll be able to use the overhead projector, and I'll be much more comfortable than I am now. But what I'm going to do today is two things. I want to talk about how I have muddled my way into and through risk communication, and that's going to be the first theme. And the second thing I want to talk about, because it's hard for me to imagine that anyone's actually interested in the first, is something I learned along the way that I think is relevant to the work we all do, and perhaps especially relevant to the work we're doing doing right now with regard to this H1N1 pandemic. This is the first flu pandemic in my professional history. I don't know about, I don't know if anyone else in the room is old enough. I was in junior high in 57. I was in grad school in 68. I don't remember either of those pandemics. So it's nice, just before I retired, God gave me a pandemic. and gave me a mild one, which is even better, because I don't have to feel so guilty about enjoying working on the pandemic. But the second thing I'm going to be talking about is something I learned over the last 40 years in risk communication, and in a nutshell, what it is nobody is trustworthy. We need to work harder to be trustworthy, but I think in some ways more important, we need to stop expecting and seeking to be trusted. We should aim, all of us, instead to be accountable. This turns out to be a lesson that good guys like public health professionals have a harder time learning than bad guys like corporate executives. So some of what I'm going to be saying in the next hour is the lessons of corporate executives for public health professionals. And if that makes you uncomfortable, that's okay. I'm uncomfortable, so we can enjoy that together. When I work with corporate executives, they may think they're honorable and trustworthy, even as they're shading the data in the service of their corporate goals. But they certainly don't expect to be trusted. Public health officials, by contrast, often do expect to be trusted, even as they're shading the data toward their public health goals. And that keeps them, it seems to me, that keeps getting them into trouble. I gave a presentation somewhat like this, not really like this, because it didn't have a history, but I gave a presentation on accountability to the vaccination people at the CDC about a year ago. And Chris, you remember this presentation. And I made the point that public health people lie a lot and distort a lot. And I gave 8 or 9 examples. And it was very interesting because about half the people in the room were doing this. And about half the people in the room were doing this. There was considerable agreement that, yeah, we do that. And there was considerable resistance to acknowledge that, yeah, we do that. So that's some of what I want to be talking about. But I want to get there, because I promised I would, by sort of taking you through my history in risk communication. And that history starts in 1969, when I was just starting on my doctoral dissertation, which was on the glorious topic, why book publishers publish so many books they know in advance will lose money. If that sounds interesting to you, see me during the break and I still remember what I concluded. That was going to be my dissertation. But I was deflected from that dissertation because Ronald Reagan, who was then governor of California, Richard Nixon was president, Reagan invited Nixon's Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, a man named Robert Finch, to come give a speech on the Berkeley campus. Okay. Berkeley was then very much a center of student unrest. I was down the road at comparatively placid Stanford, but we would go to Berkeley when we wanted to see some excitement. So Finch spoke at Berkeley, and there were student protesters. And Finch took offense at the protesters and said, why are you protesting? You're students. If you don't like the way the government is handling these social issues, you should be doing research. Why haven't you sent HEW research proposals? And some aide whispered in his ear that actually HEW doesn't accept research proposals from students. And Finch said, well, we should. And he turned back to the crowd and he said, if there's anyone out there that would like to do research on social problems instead of protesting, send your proposal directly to my attention. Now, I was not at Berkeley. I was at Stanford. But I happened to hear that on the radio. I was with several other graduate students, friends of mine. And we decided it would be fun to call this bluff. So we ginned up a proposal to study various aspects of environmental communication. And we sent that proposal, and it was funded directly out of some small slush fund in the Secretary's Office of Health, Education, and Welfare. So I jumped my dissertation on book economics, and I did a dissertation on what I called eco-pornography, how dishonest environmental appeals in product advertising affects people's environmental values. And I was on my way to becoming an environmental communication expert. I got my PhD in 1971, and my first full-time teaching job was at the journalism school at Ohio State University. As a newly minted PhD, I did what all newly minted PhDs do. I did research for publication in journals that was grounded very much in my dissertation. It was the only thing I'd ever done, so I got as much value out of it as I possibly could and did sort of derivative research based on my dissertation, which extended my reputation as an expert in environmental communication. Now, you have to understand, there were approximately two in the world. It's not as if environmental communication were a hot field, but such as it was, I was in the center of it. And as a result, I got a call in 1972 from a man named Bill Stapp in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Michigan. And he said they were starting a graduate program in environmental communication that was going to be the first graduate program in environmental communication ever in the world. And would I come run it? Or at least, would I apply to come run it? And I said, sure. So I went to Ann Arbor to interview. I should tell you, by the way, that I ultimately got the job. And the thing that persuaded me was not that it was environmental, which I kind of was looking to get out of. But my salary at Ohio State was $13,500 a year. And at University of Michigan, they offered me $16,600 a year. That was a hell of a raise. So that's why I went. But before I went, I had to go through the interview process. And I was interviewed by two search committees, a faculty committee and a student committee. The student, this was, after all, the early 70s, you know, the student committee asked me to describe my commitment to the environment. And I said I didn't have any. I said, it seemed to me that they had enough commitment to the environment for both of us, that what I had was some expertise in communication that people committed to the environment could probably use. They didn't like that answer, and I sensed that they didn't like that answer. So I added, and this actually maybe helped, I doubt it, I added that they shouldn't worry because I would probably wind up committed to the environment because that's what happens when you work in a field day in and day out. And I introduced them to the concept of cognitive dissonance, which some of you may have heard about, and you will, if you come tomorrow, you will hear a little bit about tomorrow. I said, you know, it's a mistake for you guys to imagine that, you know, you have your values and they therefore lead to behavior. It's far more common that behavior leads to values than values leads to behavior. And since I'm going to have to work with all you environmental freaks, I'll wind up one myself. So you don't have to worry about the fact that I'm not yet a true believer. And I gather that after I left, there was quite a large debate about whether people who weren't true believers should be allowed to teach and or even to run this new program. But ultimately, I got the job, and I became an environmentalist. And in the next 5 years, I helped train a generation of then young student environmental activists who went on to run a lot of environmental organizations. And you know, this is what happens when you get old. People that you knew when you were young become important. And a lot of the students that I trained are now running environmental groups in the US and elsewhere. What I was doing in those days is what I now call precaution advocacy. High hazard, low outrage, risk communication. Now, most of my work in precaution advocacy was with environmental activist groups because that, you know, they were paying my my salary. But I also worked with other good guys, and among the good guys I worked with very early on was the American College of Physicians. In the mid-1970s, I started working with them. I did several papers for their conferences. I published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And I became sort of the American College of Physicians expert in communication, to the extent that they had one. By the way, in 1977, I gave a paper at the American College of Physicians annual meeting in Dallas. The paper was entitled, "The Swine Flu Fiasco, What We Did Wrong." I have no idea what it said. These were pre-computer days. I can't find my notes. I'm sure they were on yellow paper, because that's how I took speech notes in those days, but I can't find them. But at least I know that I once knew what we did wrong in communicating about swine flu. I figured I would spend my life helping good guys arouse concern in apathetic publics. I figured that was my niche in life. And then in March of 1979 came a watershed event for me, the Three Mile Island nuclear power accident. Since I had published it a lot on environmental communication, the Columbia Journalism Review, which was then the leading publication in sort of media studies in looking at journalists and how they behave, they asked me to go to the scene of Three Mile Island and cover the coverage. Everyone else there, lots of people left, but the folks who were there were of course paying attention to the accident, but I was the only one there that was sort of going meta and paying attention to how the reporters and the sources were covering the accident. And I wrote with a colleague named Mary Payton, a very long cover article for Columbia Journalism Review on Three Mile Island communication, which led to my being invited to be a staff member of the Kemeny Commission, appointed by President Carter to investigate the Three Mile Island accident. My piece of the responsibility was to figure out who knew what when, and who lied, and who distorted, and who told the truth. I was basically studying the flacking at Three Mile Island, also the reporting, but much more the flacking. It's, by the way, the only time in my life that I have had subpoena power, which, if you have never had subpoena power, I recommend it. It's great fun. My work for the Kemeny Commission contributed to recommendations and then regulatory requirements about how utilities needed to be prepared to communicate during a nuclear accident. And as a result of those requirements, I started getting phone calls from nuclear utilities asking, would you come help us as a consultant figure out how to implement these regulations, these new regulations? I didn't want to lose my virginity by working for the bad guys, so, and I explained to them that, I'm an activist, I don't work with nuclear utilities. And they said, well, gee, you helped write the legislation, didn't you? And I said, yes. And they said, well, don't you think it would be useful to help us obey the legislation, the new regulations? And they kind of had me. And I couldn't think of an honorable reason not to help nuclear utilities do better communication during a nuclear accident. So I did my first corporate consulting. I should tell you, as a result of that consulting, a local activist from the Three Mile Island area had my name removed from a list of academic consultants that activist groups ought to work with. There was, for all I know, there may still be, a list of sort of sympathetic academics that, that activists can hire to bring in and advise them. And I was on that list, and very proud to be on that list. This activist, Judy Johnswood, got me off the list because I had, after all, worked for nuclear utilities. I came away thinking that working for industry was dangerous to my activist career. I also came away thinking that industry was, kind of interesting. They were organized by what you do, what you know, what you think. Activists, on the other hand, seemed chiefly interested in which side you're on. And that was a lesson that I should, this has happened a lot in my career. I imagine it's happened in some of your careers. As I talk about being kicked off the list of people that are allowed to consult for activists, I'm reminded of the fact that every time I work for the World Health Organization, I have to sign something that says, I have never worked for the tobacco industry. I have never worked for the tobacco industry. But I'm sure if I did, they wouldn't make me sign something saying I've never worked for the World Health Organization. So there is an interesting lack of symmetry there. Industry loves the fact that I work for activists. Activists hate the fact that I work for industry. The bad guys will work with anyone who can help them. The good guys are likelier to have loyalty oaths. I came away from Three Mile Island with a new intellectual frame. Okay, until then, virtually all my work had been figuring out how to arouse concern in apathetic publics. Now, as a result of Three Mile Island, I had a sense that sometimes people are excessively concerned about small risks. And sometimes people are appropriately concerned about serious risks. That people aren't always apathetic. Apathy, addressing apathy isn't the only problem risk communicators have. That was a new thought for me that came as a direct result of Three Mile Island. I had understood early on that the problem wasn't panic. There was very little panic at Three Mile Island, though officials and journalists kept thinking that people were panicking. In fact, people weren't panicking. They were upset. And they had what looked at the time to be very good reason to be upset. It turned out ultimately that Three Mile Island had negligible impact on health. Nothing horrible happened. In fact, there's apparently a very good case to be made that because so many factories shut down as a result of the Three Mile Island accident, it actually improved health. I keep interrupting my interruptions, but that's all right. It might strike you as analogous to that, that if in fact the pandemic we're all coping with remains as mild as it is now, and if it successfully supplants the seasonal flu, it too may save lives. Raise your hand if that's occurred to you before. Only a few of you. It isn't going to kill 36,000 people if it stays the way it is now. And if it doesn't kill 36,000 people, and if it replaces the seasonal flu, we'll all be in the interesting position sometime at the end of the pandemic of explaining that we were right to be really worried about it even though it saved lives. But in any case, I wasn't worried about panic. I absolutely understood that Three Mile Island was not about panic. But what I did get as a result of Three Mile Island is a more symmetrical frame for my risk communication work. Okay? That it was not just how do you alert apathetic people, but also how do you reassure over-alarmed people, and how do you guide appropriately alarmed people. Okay? Nonetheless, I went back to working with the good guys. I had plenty of examples of corporate dishonesty from Three Mile Island that persuaded me or reminded me that I didn't like working with bad guys. Just to tell you one such story, my favorite story from Three Mile Island. The PR guy for Metropolitan Edison, the utility, was a man named Lane Fabian. He had announced very early on day one of the accident, he had announced, and this is a direct quote, "The plant," he said, "is cooling according to design." So, after I had subpoena power and I was doing investigations for the Kennedy Commission, I sat down with Fabian and I said, "How could you say that? There was a bubble in the containment that everybody thought was likely to explode. There was a valve stuck open that was pumping radiation where it shouldn't be. All kinds of things were going wrong. How could you possibly have issued a statement that the plant was cooling according to design?" And he said, "Peter, that's what's so wonderful about nuclear power plants. They're designed to cool in emergency conditions. They're designed to cool even when all sorts of things are going wrong. So yes, we did have a lot of malfunctions, Nonetheless, the plant was cooling according to design. He downplayed the malfunctions without quite lying. When I went back to working with the good guys, maybe because of my experience with corporate consulting, I started noticing that the good guys weren't exactly honest either. In 1981, I started doing communication work with the American Cancer Society. One of the big ACS activities then as now was corporate smoking cessation programs. And in order to sell these programs, we decided, I was on the communication committee of the Cancer Society, we decided that we would commission an economist to do a study to document how much money corporations would save if they sponsored smoking cessation clinics. Remember, this was 1981. Okay. The study came back. We figured it would show a big cost to companies as a result of medical expenses. What the study actually showed is that employees who smoke actually saved their company's money. Pension money, mostly. But also healthcare money, because they died rapidly after retirement. The ideal economic death is someone who works a very productive life and dies fairly quickly soon after retiring. And smoking accomplishes that for millions of people. And was therefore a very good economic deal for employers. So when we told employers that it was in their economic interest to support smoking cessation, we were wrong. And now we knew we were wrong. What do you think we did?
Did you tell them that? No, you did not.
We did not tell them that. And I argued for releasing the study and saying there were nonetheless reasons to do smoking cessation, and I lost. And then my backup argument was, well, at least let's stop lying to them, let's stop telling them that it's good for their business, when we now know that it's not good for their business. And I lost that one too. And the Cancer Society continued, for all I know, it continues to this day, to say to companies that they can save money by supporting smoking cessation. Which wasn't true, which we knew as of 1981, wasn't true. I was told pretty explicitly that public health was a higher value than transparency.
Ooh.
Now, the difference that I detect between the Cancer Society and the Metropolitan Edison Utility Company is Blaine Fabian had to find a way to mislead people without actually lying. But the Cancer Society was content to lie. That was the difference. Similarly, well, I'm going to skip that story. You already look depressed. I'm going to skip that one. And I'm going to come back to issues of integrity, but let me move on to something else. The years from 1985 to 1987 were pivotal to me in a lot of ways in my risk communication development. For one thing, 1985 was the year when I met Jody Lenard, who later became my wife and my partner, and who is here today. Jody was a psychiatrist trained in family systems theory. Pretty soon she was giving me comments on all my work, and my work as a result got a lot more shrinky. And some of what is now, some of what are now my signature concepts, like the risk communication seesaw, if you don't know about the seesaw, I'll tell you about it tomorrow, came from Jody and from her work in family systems theory within psychiatry. Much later, during the SARS outbreak, Jody started doing her own risk communication work, especially on infectious disease outbreaks and other emergency situations in developing countries. I started with a wife and wound up with a business partner who's also my wife. Also in 1985, a brand new radiological risk surfaced. Literally surfaced. Radon. Some of you know, and many of you probably don't, radon is a decay product of uranium in the soil. If there is uranium in the soil, radon, because it's a gas, when the uranium decays into radon, the radon rises through the rock and soil. If it happens to hit the surface under somebody's house, it rises into their house where it collects and causes lung cancer. And radon is thought to be the second largest cause, second biggest cause of lung cancer after smoking. It's especially big in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, which are on a deposit of uranium-bearing soil called the Redding Prong. Radon surface is an issue only in 1985. Interestingly, I discovered that the Pennsylvania Bureau of Radiation Protection had been thinking about doing something about radon back in 79, but Three Mile Island happened instead. And they became very preoccupied with Three Mile Island and forgot to get around to radon. This is one on a long list of high outrage risks that distract public servants from high hazard risks. So we sort of lost a decade on radon because we were worrying about nuclear power plant accidents. Some of you may wonder what we are losing right now because we're worrying about a very mild pandemic. Or some of you may not be worried about that. when radon first surfaced, New Jersey and Pennsylvania environmental health officials were convinced the problem was going to be panic. Again, a leitmotif of the day. I thought the problem was going to be apathy. And when they commissioned Neil Weinstein and me to start doing research on how to talk to people about radon, the first research we did was to try to determine how much panic or anxiety or, you know, over-alarm we were going to encounter and how much apathy and complacency and absence of interest we were going to encounter so that we could figure out the relative size of those two problems. And we were able to document that officials who, as always, expected panic were, as usual, wrong. Neil and I spent the last half of the 1980s studying how to persuade apathetic people to test their homes for radon and to remediate if they found much. And I will talk some more about that work tomorrow. It gave rise to something called the precaution adoption process model, which is a theory that Neil more than I developed and he has run with ever since, and it's become quite well known among experts in precaution advocacy and how do you alert people to new risks as a very sophisticated model with some very unobvious implications for how do you get people to take risks seriously when they're not emotionally upsetting, when they're not high outrage. In keeping with my leitmotif that good guys are no more honest than bad guys, though I want to make sure you understand, in the service of a better cause, I mean, it's better to be dishonest to save people's lives than to get their money. But there's not a real difference in how honest we are. Let me tell you a radon story. The lion's share of radon risk is to smokers. The reason for that is because the way radon usually causes lung cancer is radon further decays into a variety of substances called radon daughters. Those radon daughters, if you are in a house with a lot of smoke, if you are a smoker or live with a smoker, the radon daughters attach themselves to the smoke particles and ride the smoke particles into the lungs. Absent a smoking environment, much less radon gets into the lungs, and radon is therefore, absent a smoking environment, much less harmful. So the vast majority of the damage, of the health damage done by radon, is done to smokers and to people who live with smokers. Radon keeps company then, as a health problem, with smoking and secondhand smoke. EPA knew that from the outset. But it went out of its way to underplay the relationship between radon risk and smoking. It didn't want to give non-smokers a sense that radon wasn't really very serious, because it wanted them to take it seriously. And it didn't want to give smokers a sense that if they coped with their radon problem, it was okay to keep smoking. So all the EPA materials for the general public averaged smoker and non-smoker risk. They thereby understated the risk to smokers by a little and overstated the risk to non-smokers by a lot. Raise your hand. end, if this reminds you of anything in the flu world. No hands. Well, I mean, let me be the first to tell you. How about our endless mantra that the seasonal flu kills 36,000 Americans a year? Some of you know, and some of you, I suspect, don't know, 90% of those 36,000 Americans are 65 and over. Only, 3,600 or so Americans under 65 die of flu in the average year. Seasonal flu, and this is very much unlike pandemic flu, which is largely a disease of the young, seasonal flu is mostly an inconvenience to the young and a serious threat to the elderly. Seniors are 12.5% of the U.S. population. They are 90% of the flu deaths. Very much like EPA and radon, CDC and state health departments and county health departments and all the organizations, or nearly all the organizations you work for, are not in a hurry to emphasize that during an ordinary flu year. For exactly the same reasons as CDC's reasons, you want young people to get vaccinated, partly because if young people are vaccinated, they are less likely to give their grandparents the flu. Partly because if young people are vaccinated, it will build the market for vaccines. We manufacture as many vaccines next year as we sold this year. Partly because you want to build the habit of getting vaccinated. And partly because a week of feeling crappy is no picnic. And getting vaccinated against something that is a very small threat to your life is perhaps not stupid anyway. But the point is, like EPA, without exactly lying, we have given people the impression that when we say again and again and again and again that 36,000 Americans a year die, and we don't say 90% of them are over 65, we have given the impression, or we have at least tried, we may not have succeeded, to give the impression that flu is much more dangerous to young people than it actually is. Exactly what EPA was doing with radon. By the way, that makes it much harder to explain the pandemic now. Now we finally have a flu that afflicts mostly the young. Okay? And if it stays the way it is now, and we can't bet that it's going to stay the way it is now, flus don't have to stay the way they are. The second and third wave don't have to be like the first. But if it stays the way it is now, it's going to kill a lot fewer than 36,000 Americans this year, but it will kill more than 3,600 young Americans. Okay. So this is literally not your grandfather's flu. But it's very hard to explain that credibly and meaningfully and impactfully and dramatically to people without coming out of the closet about the fact that the annual flu, the seasonal flu, is your grandfather's flu, and for you it's not a big deal. So one of the barriers that many of my clients have had explaining the pandemic is their history of less than candid explanations of the seasonal flu. Are you with me?
Yeah.
I'm just curious, how many of you is this new technical information? You didn't know this. Only a few of you. So most of you knew it. So you are a part of the conspiracy, correct? Presumably you put out communications that said 36,000 and didn't say 90% elderly. Okay. So you are part of, don't feel bad. So am I. We're all dishonest. That's the message of this. I realize that the previous speaker said that these stories should have heroes and solutions, and all I've got is villains and problems. There it is. I don't want to imply that the good guys never tell the truth. And for that matter, I don't want to imply that the good guys never put telling the truth ahead of achieving programmatic goals. 1985 was also the first year that I worked for the Environmental Defense Fund. I worked for them for more than 20 years. I stopped working with them fairly recently. Fred Krupp, EDF's executive director, for all these many years, was a student of mine at Michigan in the 1970s. I actually helped EDF hire him. Early in my work with the Environmental Defense Fund, the organization was launching its signature campaign against dioxin. A factoid of enormous interest to the campaign, and especially to the communication people, including me, was that human breast milk contained detectable and increasing amounts of dioxin. And we thought this was wonderful. We said, terrific, you know, what a wonderful thing to stress in our messaging. Because of dioxin pollution, it's not safe to nurse your baby. EDF scientist Ellen Silvergill, now at Johns Hopkins, refused to let us say that. She said, the evidence that breastfeeding is preferable to bottle feeding is much stronger than the evidence that small amounts of dioxin actually does harm to infants. And on that basis, she said, persuading mothers to bottle feed their children out of a fear of dioxin would be doing damage to the children. And that our anti-dioxin campaign was not an excuse for telling parents things that would undermine, in ways that were not good science, that would undermine their faith in breastfeeding. So we wound up saying something much wimpier about how awful it was that the purity and wonderful, the wonderfully pure experience of nursing your baby was contaminated by this dioxin, which isn't nearly as effective as, you know, you can't nurse your baby because of this evil dioxin. But Ellen Silvergill, very much to her credit, was insistent on our not doing collateral harm by saying dishonest things in the service of our campaign. That was, I have to say, more the exception than the rule. Also in the mid to late 1980s, risk communication was invented. It's amazing to me to have been part of the invention of something that actually now exists. I met somebody on an airplane a couple of months ago when we were having our the small talk you sometimes have on airplanes, and I said, what do you do? And she said, I'm in risk communication. And that was the first time I've ever met someone I didn't know who told me they were in risk communication. And it was very hard not to giggle. Yeah, I mean, she actually thinks it's a field. You know? But it was invented in the mid to late 1980s. The first national conference with the phrase risk communication in its title took place in January 1986 in Washington, D.C. It was called National Conference on Risk Communication. And was sponsored jointly by the Environmental Protection Agency, National Science Foundation, and the Conservation Foundation. I gave two presentations. There, of course, had been related fields for a long time. Health communication existed, safety communication existed, environmental communication existed. I helped create that one, too. But two things distinguish the new field of risk communication. First of all, unlike the other three, it didn't start with the assumption that the risk is dangerous and the problem is apathy. Risk communication, at least at this conference, started with the opposite assumption. The preoccupation of this conference was how do we calm people down who are unduly upset about small hazards? EPA, for example, was very worried that people were freaking out about hazardous waste sites and freaking out about nuclear power plants. So that there were sessions at this first risk communication conference with titles like Building Trust and Credibility and this is my favorite, Nuclear Power and Nuclear Phobia. Very much an interest in how do we reassure people who are unduly alarmed. The other thing that was unique about risk communication is from the outset it conceptualized the communication task as a dialogue, not a monologue. Alerting apathetic people really is a monologue, mostly. I mean, apathetic people have very little they want to say back. You're lucky if you can get them to listen. You can't walk up to an apathetic person and say, let's chat about this thing you don't care about. But when people are upset, when people are concerned, when people are outraged, then if you're going to have any impact, whatever, it has to be a dialogue. Okay, so that sense that we're dealing with people who are excessively rather than insufficiently alarmed, and that we have to listen to them, not just talk to them, those were at the
core
of risk communication from the very beginning in 1986. I have to stop for a minute. I know we started about half an hour late. I don't know what time I'm supposed to stop.
You have about 15 or 20 minutes.
15 or 20 minutes, okay. Would you, you know...
I'll give you a high sign.
Give me a high sign when I have like 5 minutes. This was also when I came up with the formula, about 1986, 87, when I came up with a formula that's on my business card and that sent my children to college. The risk equals hazard plus outrage formula, which I will talk about at great length tomorrow. But just in case you're not coming tomorrow, I may have persuaded you not to come tomorrow, what I'm saying today. I was becoming aware as a result, first of Three Mile Island and then of the invention of risk communication, I was becoming aware of the fact that alerting apathetic people was only a piece of the problem. That sometimes people are apathetic about a serious risk and you need to alert them. Sometimes people are upset about a small risk and you need to reassure them. Sometimes people are upset about a serious risk and you need to guide them. And those of you who are seeing this as a 2x2 table, are they upset or not? Is it serious or not? There is the fourth corner of that 2x2 table. Sometimes people are apathetic about a trivial risk, and you should leave them alone. Because they got it right, you know. You ought not to be talking to them. I had earlier on, a few years earlier, I had framed that as apathy versus hysteria. And it really wasn't until 86, 87 that I reframed it as hazard versus outrage. In 1987, I published my last article with the word hysteria in the title and my first article with the word outrage in the title. And that first article, which was entitled Facing Public Outrage, published in EPA Journal, had this paragraph, which I could, you know, I mean, nothing has changed about this paragraph. I could write this paragraph today. Here's what I wrote. To the experts, risk means expected annual mortality. But to the public, and even the experts when they go home at night, risk means much more than that. Let's redefine terms. Call the death rate, what the experts mean by risk, hazard. Call the other factors, collectively, outrage. Risk, then, is the sum of hazard and outrage. The public pays too little attention to hazard. The experts pay absolutely no attention to outrage. Not surprisingly, they rank risks differently. And risk equals hazard plus outrage became my trademark, although I didn't trademark it. So you're all free to use it without charge. Finally, the last of many things that happened to me in the mid to late 1980s, I gave corporate consulting another try. As it had the first time, this resulted from my research activities. I had a colleague at Rutgers University, I was now teaching at Rutgers, named Michael Greenberg. He was a geographer turned cancer epidemiologist. And he'd become very interested in how the media cover environmental risk. His main concern was how the media covered him and the ways in which his discussions of New Jersey as Cancer Alley were getting covered. So he asked me to join him in doing research on how the media cover risk issues. And we ended up getting a series of grants from something called the Hazardous Substance Research Center, an industry-funded consortium. Once again, I feared for my purity. Once again, I made a big point of insisting that I would not tolerate any interference from these corporate funders. In particular, I insisted I would never let them edit my conclusions, any of the conclusions in my reports, just because they didn't like those conclusions. Rather, to my disappointment, they never tried to alter my conclusions. What they did is endlessly invite me to come talk to their companies about the research. And as had happened with Three Mile Island, I didn't see an honorable way to take their money to do research and then refuse to talk to them about what I found. So I wound up giving speeches to, you figure out what kind of company is going to spend significant sums of money to join something called the Hazardous Substance Research Center. They're all companies that emit large amounts of hazardous substances. And I wound up giving them presentations on how to talk about what they do. My main messages were things like acknowledge your prior misbehavior, acknowledge your current problems, admit your emissions aren't zero risk, give credit to your critics for making you improve. These are all things that I lumped together, and I dubbed this set of strategies outrage management. You know, this is what you do when people are excessively alarmed, as opposed to insufficiently alarmed, and we will talk about that at some length tomorrow. So by the late 1980s, I had become an increasingly successful corporate consultant. I was even beginning to enjoy it. I was making a lot of money. And I gave up my Rutgers professorship and went into full-time consulting. I have been a full-time consultant ever since. I tried to divide my life, my time, my work time, roughly evenly among the three kinds of risk communication. I hope you sort of divine from this narrative what those are. Precaution advocacy is alerting apathetic people to serious risks. Outrage management is reassuring upset people about small risks. Crisis communication is guiding appropriately upset people through serious risks. I try to divide my time equally among those three. They don't pay equally. Just out of curiosity, make sure you guys understand capitalism. Which of those three do you think pays best?
Public health.
Yeah, right. Outrage management. The budget for reassuring people when they're over-alarmed is extremely large. The budget for guiding people through crises is modest, and the budget for alerting people, apathetic people, to serious risks is tiny. So in dividing my time roughly equally, I get to tell myself, and sometimes to tell my clients, particularly my corporate clients, that they are subsidizing my work with activist groups and public health agencies. They are. I don't want to leave the impression, by the way, that it's always corporations doing outrage management and it's always activist groups and public health agencies doing crisis communication or precaution advocacy, because that's not true. Companies, for example, have a lot of occasion to do precaution advocacy in the safety arena, where they're trying to persuade employees to take safety precautions seriously. Wear your hard hat, you know, wear your respirator. And these messages are very difficult, because hard hats and respirators, are, particularly respirators, are uncomfortable. So there's a lot of precaution advocacy going on inside of corporations. And increasingly, there is outrage management going on in advocacy groups and public health agencies. And Rishi is nodding her head blindly, because she's at the center of an enormous need to do outrage management around vaccination. One of my first uses of outrage management, the corporate skill set, with activist groups was with Environmental Defense Fund. They had successfully persuaded the government to require an enormous amount of testing of chemicals that had never been properly tested. They had been grandfathered because they were been in use for so long. And they'd never really been tested properly. And EDF succeeded in persuading EPA to require the chemical companies test these chemicals. And of course, you know, when you test the safety of a chemical, what do you test it on? Animals. So people for the ethical treatment of animals rightly saw that Environmental Defense Fund had been responsible for the deaths of millions of rodents. And you know, you either care about that or you don't. It's an acquired taste. But PETA attacked EDF for in the way that EDF had spent decades attacking corporations for doing evil things. And my EDF clients came to me and they said, "Oh my God, you know, what do we do?" And I just said, "Think like a corporation." And I had to. I mean, you know, this proves there is a God, right? I mean, this is the wonderful moment of poetic justice of helping activist groups acquire the ability to reduce outrage when they're so good at exacerbating outrage. All right, well, I have only 5 minutes, so let me cut to the chase. Is it sufficiently clear that there is a trust problem, not just in corporations, but in public health agencies and activist groups as well. And when I say you guys have a trust problem, I don't mean the problem is you're not trusted. It's true that you're not trusted, but that's not the problem. That's an achievement. If you were trusted, you would abuse the trust, and then you'd get caught, and then you wouldn't be trusted. So working to be trusted is not the point. The point is learning how to do business when you can't assume that you are trusted. The point is coming up with mechanisms of accountability instead of relying on trust. I spent many years trying to convince various clients, especially public interest clients, to be more honest. And I still try to convince my clients to be more honest. But I also try to convince my clients, even when they are being more honest, not to expect anybody to think they're more honest. And given the history that I have sketched in a little bit, mistrusting you is wisdom. Okay. Expecting to be trusted is your problem. Your problem isn't that you're not trusted. Your problem is that you expect to be trusted. So what do I mean when I talk about accountability? One of the best established findings in the social science of science is the extremely low correlation between the findings of a study and the preferences of the funder. Okay. Research almost always finds what the person who paid for the research wants it to find. That relationship is statistically significant at p less than 0.00001. Those of you who know something about statistics know that means it is vanishingly unlikely that that result could have happened by chance. In the vast majority of cases, studies find what the funder wants them to find. Okay. So I worked years ago with the Brent Spar. It was an oil platform in the North Sea owned by Shell and Exxon jointly. And Shell and they were done with it, and they wanted to sink the Brent Spar into the North Sea. Environmentalists complained that sinking the Brent Spar in the North Sea would do enormous harm, and Shell and Exxon claimed it would. So there was a data disagreement. And Shell and Exxon did studies and said sinking the Brent Spar will do no harm. Okay? There will be no adverse events from sinking the Brent Spar. Greenpeace did its own studies and said it's going to be an environmental catastrophe if we let them sink the Brent Spar. Now, raise your hand if you trust the Shell Exxon studies. Raise your hand if you trust the Greenpeace studies. Right. We got about four people who trust Greenpeace and nobody who trusts Shell and Exxon. That's about right, there's a lot more trust of activists than there is of industry, and the vast majority trust neither one, which is wise, because they will both distort the data. Consciously or unconsciously, that's how we get this finding that studies almost invariably reach conclusions that their funder likes. Now think about that when you think about the research efforts that are underway to identify adverse events from the pandemic vaccine. Should we trust vaccine proponents who tell us the vaccine is safe? Raise your hand if you think we should. Remember, these are the same people that keep saying 36,000 Americans die every year. I could give you endless examples of dishonest flu communication coming out of public health agencies. But again, my point is, if you're telling the truth, and I think you're telling the truth, about vaccine safety, I think you're almost telling the truth. I don't actually think the pandemic vaccine is just as safe as the seasonal vaccine. And the seasonal vaccine doesn't have swine pieces in it. I'd be surprised if it were just as safe. New usually means more dangerous, less tested. But I'm sure it's you're much closer to the truth than your opponents. So I think you're telling the truth. I think you're telling the truth in ways that are not credible. Or at least to the people, they're not credible. Saying it again and again and again won't help. Okay? And coming up with accountability mechanisms, coming up with ways of doing the study jointly, you know, so that you can't cheat even if you want to, and your critics can't claim you're cheating even if they want to, I think that's what corporations are learning how to do, and that's what public health agencies need to learn how to do. I'm going to skip a lot of this and skip to my, do I have 2 minutes left? Skip to my conclusion. Where's my conclusion? There it is. Okay. Two lessons for public health information professionals. Okay, because you guys are on the front lines. You have a lot of impact here. Okay. The first lesson is, you know, since much of the time your technical sources inside your agency give you an unbalanced story to start with, you need to exercise your journalistic skills. A lot of you come from journalism backgrounds. You need to be an investigative reporter inside your agency. When Jody and I encounter statements coming out of health agencies that are not accurate, or are accurate only in a very, they're accurate as in the plant is cooling according to design. When we encounter statements like that, we will typically contact the communication person who produced the statement, and much of the time, they have no idea what the statement was hiding. Okay? They simply didn't know enough to know they were being dishonest. Okay? And, you know, so that's the first problem that you need to solve. You need to push your technical sources much harder to tell you the things they don't want to tell the public, so that you at least have the whole story. And then, having used your journalistic skills to get the whole story, you need risk communication skills to decide how much of the story to tell. I am not an ethicist. I am a risk communication professional. What I can tell you is, in risk communication, when you're trying to get apathetic people more worried, you have a lot of latitude to distort. When you're trying to get upset people to calm down and be reasonable, you have no latitude to distort. So under circumstances where you are 98% right, if you hide the other 2%, your opponents will pounce on the other 2%, they will make the other 2% look like 50 or 60 or 80%, and you will lose the fight. You are losing the vaccination fight with lots and lots of people, even though you are 98% right, because you are less than candid about the other 2%. You know, in precaution advocacy, you don't have to mention the ways in which you're wrong. You can exaggerate the ways in which you're right. In outrage management, it's a different story. More and more public health agencies are doing outrage management as part of their precaution advocacy. You're spending as much time talking about the safety of the vaccine as you are talking about the dangers of the pandemic flu. And in order to do that, you need, you know, you, as public health communication professionals, need journalistic skills to dig out what your technical colleagues are hiding from you. And then you need risk communication expertise to understand why the public should be told that stuff. So I come back to trust. And I said a minute ago, or a few minutes ago, the problem isn't that you're not trusted. The problem is that you expect to be trusted. At a more fundamental level even than that, the problem is that you don't trust the public. And if you trust the public with the piece of the truth that works against your public health message, you can very significantly improve people's willingness to believe your public health message. That's the paradox of outrage management. It's something public health agencies are facing more and more and need to learn to address. So somewhere in there, I hope there's something helpful to you. Tomorrow, I'll have handouts, and I won't have PowerPoints because I hate them. They're tools of the devil. But I'll have handouts, and I'll have a whiteboard, and I'll write things, and teacher today, I was mostly remembering good times and maybe being a little bit of a preacher. Thank you.
Tomorrow we'll have more of the same, and for longer. We won't cut you off.